Okay. Recording, here we go, everybody. Hi, this is Craig Wiener. I'm here with Suzanne Fagel and, of course, lovely and fabulous Peta Stapleton. So we're here tonight from Tapping Out of Trauma. We're traversing continents around the world. And what I really want to do is just first introduce Peta, because what we're going to be talking today about is trauma and food, its relationship to eating and weight and obesity. And we're really excited to be able to have Dr. Stapleton here with us. So if somehow you don't know Dr. Peta Stapleton, I want to tell you a little bit about her. So Dr. Peta Stapleton is a registered clinical and health psychologist. She's an associate professor, program director of the Masters of Clinical Psychology program. Don't blush, Peta. Here, I'm going to keep going. At Bond University in Australia. She's a sought-after speaker, a trainer, a world-leading researcher. She leads worldwide research into psychological trials, into new therapies regarding obesity and weight management. And one of her most significant contributions in her research life has been to lead the world's first randomized controlled clinical trials, investigating the effectiveness of EFT tapping, which is why we're here. So the results of this study are comparable to traditional treatment methods for weight management like CBT, and they've established Dr. Stapleton as a world leader in the field. And we are just so grateful to have you here and to be able to talk about trauma and its regard to obesity and weight and food. And Suzanne is my partner in Tapping Out of Trauma. It's wonderful to have the three of us together. So Suzanne, I'm going to let you go ahead and get this thing started with Peta, and let's see where this takes us.
Okay, good. So first question for you, Peta, here is, people have different ways that they cope with stress in their life by either misusing or avoiding food. Wondering if you could talk a bit about the different coping mechanisms, from like occasional overeating to chronic binge eating to bulimia and anorexia.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you for both having me here today. I just wanted to stick that in there at the beginning as well. It's just a pleasure. It has been my area for, I guess, 20 odd years now, and more. Just the whole eating area, and fascinates me, I guess, about how people do cope differently. And we do seem to have two different perspectives, where on one hand, people that have really high anxiety may actually avoid food because the whole idea of having food on top of that feeling of anxiety, especially in the torso, just doesn't work for them. So we would tend to see that more with eating disorders like anorexia and nervosa, things like that. But now what we're seeing more and more, and certainly with our obesity crisis worldwide, is that people are using food to manage feelings. So they are using more than just occasional overeating. They're using it as a daily coping response. So that might be things like soothing a bad feeling with a food that they quite like, so a food craving, that kind of thing. It might be using food to not just soothe but avoid. So they might use the bad feelings about eating, you know, the whole packet of chocolate biscuits as a reason, something else to deal with other than the bad feeling they had in the first place. So what we're seeing come out of that is an increase in binge eating disorder, so as a diagnosis, and certainly obviously our obesity crisis that's happening too. We've seen some of that as a result of childhood experiences that people don't know how to deal with. So you're right, this thing has become bigger and bigger, excuse the pun, over the years, and it's not going away because children aren't learning how to cope with feelings at a much younger age. So yeah, we're certainly seeing the whole spectrum at a private practice level.
Thanks. Could we just begin maybe simply with some of your research that you found to show the primary connections or the reasons, really, that emotions and food get intertwined so interconnectedly?
Absolutely. When we untangle it, what we do find is most of those associations are set up in childhood. So if it is food is used to soothe, it may be that as a young child, you know, a parent inadvertently and unconsciously may actually use food to soothe when a child's sick. So special attention, get to stay home from school and perhaps get to, you know, have favourite food cooked for dinner or something that's a special treat. So food as a soother is taught. I can certainly remember having, I have such a small jaw that I had a lot of dental work as a kid for whatever reason, had a lot of teeth removed. And every time I had a tooth removed, I got to go to the pharmacy and get a lollipop. So I've since had that conversation with my mother and said, what were you thinking? That's just what they did. It was a soother. So you've had something, you were really brave, now here's a treat. So that gets set up in a childhood and then gets replicated later on. The other one that we see too in childhood is that food can be used as a reward. So certainly if you've done something fantastic, could be schoolwork, could be a sporting achievement, could be something else, food is used as the reward for that. So it's not necessarily take away a bad feeling or hurt, but it's fantastic, great work, here's your treat. So later on in life as an adult, if we've had a good feeling, we also seek food to reward ourselves. So most of these associations we believe are set up in the first 10 years of life, so our imprint years. And then what we do is we just repeat the pattern. So we're certainly seeing those patterns and we're using things like EFT or tapping to obviously unpack that and go back so that food can get extracted and it's no longer necessary when there's any kind of feeling good or bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. So what have you found to be some of the primary emotions or feelings that cause people to turn to food or avoid it in order to respond to those feelings?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, there is such a range of emotions that are out there. The ones we see that are more common are things like fear. So that could be frightened, scared, or an anxiety feeling, so intense anxiety as fear. Anger. Anger is a really big one, and we do look at anger as a surface emotion, that there tends to be something deeper underneath that. But anger, for whatever reason out there in the real world, becomes a legitimate reason for somebody to go and soothe. Any kind of tension that might be there for people, so agitation, that kind of thing. And the big one is that shame. So shame as a deep-rooted feeling, and beyond the feeling of guilt, shame for whatever reason is a legitimate reason for a lot of people to kind of indulge in food because they just don't have the tools or the skill or even the insight as to what is that shame about, because it could be buried from a childhood a long time ago. So they're kind of the four. And if you work out the acronym FATS, certainly, you know, it's ironic that it's FATS. But, you know, we've turned that FATS acronym from, you know, something to do with food and a bad thing into, well, actually, they're the four primary feelings that people are actually overeating. And then you've got your other bits and pieces in between there. So you might have feelings of deprivation. If somebody tells you you're not allowed to do something, it brings up that inner child that kind of wants to do it just because you've said you can't. And diets are a good example of that. You have to go on a diet. Your GP tells you, your doctor, and, of course, you have this reaction. So you have things like deprivation. You might have things like sadness and loneliness, depression. So you've got your other feelings that come in there. But those four, FATS, are four of the biggest ones that we see.
Okay.
Good. Okay. So it strikes me when you say that the FATS, fear, anger, tension, and shame, are also feelings that are very prevalent in people that we see with trauma.
Yes.
And so that kind of becomes a segue to talking about feelings and eating and trauma.
Yes.
So. Yeah. How does not dealing with these emotions relate to a history with a person with a history of trauma? How does emotional overeating and trauma linked, and what research has been published to support this connection?
And I think, you know, inadvertently, the ACE studies, the adversive childhood experience studies, highlighted this, even though perhaps they weren't necessarily looking for it. They started in that area of obesity, trying to find. And we've had some other big trials too of, you know, up to 15,000 people looked at in America as well. What we have found is that when there's four or more adversive childhood experiences, and now they could be things like emotional, sexual, physical abuse, but they could be things like only living with one or no biological parents. It could be, you know, living in poverty, that kind of thing. So an adversive childhood experience could be a range of things. Having four or more of those compared to somebody that's got none doubles the risk of obesity. So the ACE studies highlighted that for us to sort of say, actually, you know, what goes on in childhood, especially in those imprint years, has a direct response to what people then do with their food as a coping response. We've had other studies too that have shown for men and women that having childhood sexual trauma and abuse is actually then linked to an increase, 30%, 40% later adulthood obesity. So we do know now. We didn't know, I don't think, 10, 15 years ago when we started in this area, I don't think we realized that at a research level. But what we were finding is every time we started to use a technique like tapping in a session, we were suddenly the first person that had heard of this adult's childhood sexual trauma. And they'd never told anyone before, or perhaps it had just been buried so deep that it actually wasn't at the surface of their mind until tapping started. So colleagues and I would get together and sort of say, are you noticing how many people come in just for weight management or weight loss that are telling you that they were sexually abused as a child and even multiple times? And the answer was, we were all hearing the same thing. So the ACE studies confirmed a lot of that for us. And obviously we've looked beyond that too, with looking at food diaries and things like that in our research. So the link's there now, Suzanne, as you say, and the crossover is probably more prominent than what people realized.
It was actually the surprise when they first did the ACE studies, when Dr. Folletti found they were wondering why those people were stepping off that were successful from the obesity study. And it was quite a surprise to him. And I mean, that's what I really was shocked at, where the ACE study started. Even though studying obesity, they didn't make that connection that it could be between childhood adverse experiences and especially sexual abuse and obesity. And that's not saying it's for everybody, right? We're not saying everybody that's obese has had sexual abuse, of course. But
yes,
an important connection. Okay.
And I think, parallel to what we've seen in the research are all these meta-analyses that are coming out saying, well, if you just use, extra exercise and eat less, so those kind of approaches, and we've had the National Weight Registry in America keeping data for at least 30 years now, is all of the meta-analyses are showing that if you lose a certain percentage of your body weight, you'll regain it within 2 years. And within 5 years, you actually put on an extra 10 to 20%. So we've got research parallel coming out saying if you just do more exercise and eat less, it doesn't work, which then does beg the question, what else is happening in this bigger picture that we're not addressing? And I think the ACE study has answered some of that for us.
Yeah.
So if we take that further really into the psychological pathways that help to explain overeating, you've spoken about kind of the emotional triggers, which of course, like you said, the fear and anxiety and tension, et cetera. But let's take it a little bit deeper than kind of the emotions involved, what psychological pathways might be involved that are directly related from this emotional overeating and psychological into the obesity and overweight. Can you explain that a little bit deeper?
Yeah, definitely. And obviously that's the angle we come from a lot of the time. ACE studies have sort of shown us that, those childhood experiences are painful. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Traumatic, obviously. Children don't have the coping skills and even cognitive development to make sense of a lot of that, especially if the abuse is done by somebody who is close to them that is supposed to be perhaps in a role of being a protector. That confusion of that message obviously is profound. So food can become a couple of things. It can become an avoidance strategy. So if there's a food that they like, and most of these people are choosing food that they like, not dislike, so it becomes then an avoidance strategy of dissociative eating, what we call, and we've all done that at some point where we've been doing something else while we eat, look down and it's finished and don't realise we've eaten at all. So the dissociative eating to just take their mind away from what it was. It also can be, like we said, a soothing strategy. So it can be, I've got a feeling something out in my adult life has triggered that old memory. I don't know how to deal with that now as an adult either, so I use food as my coping, so my soothing, so I numb myself, that kind of thing. So we've got, I guess, those two things going on. ACE studies have shown us too that these people have such a high level of stress hormone, cortisol and inflammation in the body, that the body no longer is able to just cope normally with stress as an adult. So perhaps that's been running in the background for a long time as well. So they just don't have the normal mechanisms physiologically. So we've got, I guess, a couple of different things that are going on there. And everybody's story is unique, but it's about trying to link that together for them so that we can actually help them move forward.
And the ability, I just want to add a little bit, so the ability to resist, so you're working with the cravings, you're working with, they're driven to food to either numb or to not feel or to feel better, etc. But that inability to stop, that inability to have that decision-making frontal cortex ability to say, no, I probably shouldn't. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. And we had some of those famous studies come out, the marshmallow experiment, you might remember, Zimbardo, yes. And looking at smaller children and could they resist. And we've been able to track that through into adulthood. So you're right, willpower takes so much effort. And that's what most of our weight loss programs have been based on for years, is the notion of willpower. Willpower doesn't last enough over time, though, and things erode that. So stress erodes willpower. Any other kind of intense feeling will erode that. So people don't have that ability necessarily when they've had this, lifelong experience or pattern in just trying to survive, be in survival mode and just cope. So it's hard then by the end of the day to come home if you've had a stressful day or whatever that's been, work, children, family, whatever it is, to then come home and resist the chocolate biscuits or the ice cream after dinner or the takeaway meal on the way home instead of cooking or whatever it might be. So willpower doesn't last, which is why I guess all our weight loss stuff is very much pitched at. We have zero willpower. If you've used your willpower up as well at work, by the time you get home, it's all over as far as food goes. You just give in. So you're absolutely right.
Okay. switching gears here just a little bit. In our last teleclass with Mark Willin, we talked about how trauma passes through generations. Mm-hmm. And wondering if you know your thoughts or any research about how this might be true for weight and trauma.
Yes.
Or
yes.
How it manifests as weight.
We have recently started to look into this area, and it was unexpected. We didn't realise what we were looking for, but we'd asked all of the people in our tapping weight loss trials to keep food diaries. And we noticed that when we started to analyse those, most of them were women. Men didn't seem very good at keeping a daily diary, so we mostly had women that we were looking at. But what we found was the average age of the women in our trials were 55. So we were like, okay, that's just the age. They tend to have tried every other weight loss program, willing to give tapping a go, even if it seemed a bit strange to them. So these were the women that were mostly of that age in our trial. So we start to go through their food diaries and they're writing things about, having to eat food. And then we started to kind of look further and look at their mother's, father's relationship with food and where they came from and their grandparents. And lo and behold, their parents and their grandparents came out of the Great Depression and World War II, where food was scarce. So we started to ask that line of questioning and started to say, what do you remember about growing up with food and what was the idea around wasting food? And this is a major area traditional weight loss programs miss completely. And most of them have this enormous reaction to the wasting of food. And not because food is scarce in their lifetime now, because it's come from a generation earlier. So then that field that Mark probably alluded to of epigenetics, so the epigenome being the casing around our DNA, which stores genetic material that can be changed, has now become, and obviously, Dr. Bruce Lipton's work has now become such a focus, because that genetic material can actually be turned off and turned on, as in the expression. So we started to kind of dig deeper and started to look wider and started to go, I wonder if obesity is not necessarily a gene that's being handed on to another generation, because we know fear is being handed on through when we look at our research around rats and things like that. Fear is being handed on at an epigenome level. But we're wondering too now, is the obesity stuff and things like wastage around food and soothing, eating food as a soother, if your parent did that, is that something that you're getting handed on at this level, not just through modelling and things like that? So we're quite excited that this year we start a whole bunch of research through Bond University, where we're going to look at the epigenetic contribution to food, and we'll do that through blood testing, through the RNA. So I have a researcher in America going to do that for us. So we're going to look at that. We'll be able to tell if that information in the epigenome actually comes from another generation. And we think the answer is yes. It's just now a matter of finding the proof in the pudding. So it's there for trauma, but I think it's there for food issues as well.
Well, your point about food wastage is so interesting, because I mean, I certainly know almost everybody I know will not want to waste any food on their plate, and the idea of just throwing it away is like horrifying. And yet, as you say, most of us live in a situation of abundance. It's not a matter of there's no food, but it is interesting to see the correlate between the previous generation who really did live in times where food was not available.
Yeah, the anxiety that it causes them. So even though we use tapping to decrease the interest or the food craving, and someone will sit there and say, I have zero interest in eating this, you know, bun with icing on it. Nothing about it is attractive to me, but I'll override that and eat it instead of throwing it in the bin. Because the anxiety that comes up with the idea of wasting it or throwing it out is so intense, they're prepared to override that. And I think that is happening with our emotional eating kind of, and our binge eating disorder, is they override it to get rid of another bad feeling, which is worse to cope with. And that could be guilt. So guilt is a big one that comes in there. If I throw this away, I'm a bad person. So they would rather override that they don't want to eat it to not have the feeling of guilt. It's very complex.
it's really fascinating. I mean, I'm sure many of us grew up with the injunction, you know, you eat what's on your plate, the starving kids in name the country, you know, you've got to eat for them. You know, made no sense, but it definitely sinks in there for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's almost like we say it's ingrained, but what it is it's probably in the epigenome. It is literally genetic material. So, yeah, no wonder people just can't get over it, you know, like we said in the beginning. Right.
But it is a very interesting factor. And, in fact, one of your partners in your work, Glenn, suggests leaving a few bites of food on the plate just for that reason alone and just get rid of it. And I found that a fascinating exercise myself. So, yeah, it's a big deal, much more so than anybody might imagine.
Yes, I agree.
So a few thoughts I have with that. In between that which I've lived through, and in between that which my parents have lived through biologically and passed on, what around perinatal experience have you noticed with regard to its influence?
Yeah, definitely. And I have a PhD student looking at things like this at the moment. So there is research that suggests that not just the state of mum's emotional state that she's in when she's pregnant, because obviously, you know, baby's absorbing all of those states. But we now know too that mum's food preferences when she's pregnant seem to also be passed on to the baby. So there's something in there epigenetically too. I think we're still at the very start and forefront of that type of research, because there's a lot of schools of thought that can't quite get their head around that babies can be affected by that. But there's other research that's showing that at that perinatal level, emotional state of mum, food preferences, and I can talk from my own personal experiences that I don't eat tomatoes. So I just dislike tomatoes, which my husband says I should do tapping on, but I have no interest in doing that. As when we have two daughters, when both of them were small and you'd make up their little plate of food, we would chop up cherry tomatoes and give them to them, you know, 25 times is the average time you've got to present a food to a child before they'll decide they dislike it. So I follow all of that. Both girls will not eat tomatoes, and my husband firmly blames me, and it probably is me, because at some level I don't eat them. I did give them, but they both have an intense dislike of them, even though they were presented with them. So it's like, what's happening there? You know, it's not just a copying behavior because they were given them. So there is a lot of impact there. So if mum, I guess, you know, is eating a certain type of food or not eating enough nutritious or just doesn't have the preference for it. Babies they're vulnerable to having that stuff stored in the epigenome.
Yes. Another question I had was, we go back and forth between food, weight gain, obesity. Is there any kind of research, or have you noticed clinically, the more trauma, the greater tendency towards obesity? In other words, is there any direct correlation between the amount of weight gain, movement toward obesity as opposed to marginal weight gain, with number of ACEs, with amount of trauma one's lived through? I'm just wondering what you've been seeing and noticed with that.
Yeah. I mean, ACE is suggesting, you know, four or more kind of experiences doubles your risk of obesity. I'm finding it's an individual case by case, because it really is the definition of trauma for a client. So for a client, it could be just there was one event only, sexual abuse by their brother, for example, and that was enough for them, where weight, and we haven't really touched on this, but weight becomes a protective device for a lot of people. So often when you delve back in the history of when did your weight gain start, it's often, and my rule of thumb clinically is, it's within 12 months of an adverse experience. It's not necessarily the next month afterwards. The brain has a delay. So we always look within a year. So what happened? Okay, you gained weight then, you were 7 or 8. What happened a year earlier than that? So that tends to tell us more of an answer, and it works with eating disorders as well. When did your symptoms start? So it's really very individual. For somebody, they can have years worth of negative and traumatic experiences and end up obese. And for another person, it can be one only. And weight becomes the answer to stopping that happening again, especially if it's sexual abuse at a physical level. And time again, when I've dug back, weight gain, whether it started at 8 years of age or 18 years of age, was very much about, I'm never having that happen again, and I have to give a message now that I'm not attractive. And the more weight I can put on will protect me from that, because their weight loss journeys always trigger that. So if they start to lose weight and ever get close to people saying, wow, you look amazing, you've lost a lot of weight, that's the trigger to put it back on, because it's unsafe. So that's actually what we see.
And that's a great recommendation for tapping practitioners, and why we commonly say what was happening up until a year before, whatever situation, weight gain, etc. And that's a great example right there of why you can't just ask what happened immediately prior.
Yeah, exactly. Got to go back further.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the research, because you've really conducted quite a variety, body, weight, image, food addiction, food restraint. So all of those things. Could you talk about some of the studies and what you're finding, what you're most passionate about now, and what's been most interesting and most valuable? Because so many of the people that are going to be listening are tapping practitioners. And you know what? I have to imagine that for almost everybody, emotional eating is going to come up for them in their practice. So what, you could talk a little bit about the research so that they know it's out there, and then we can send them to be resourced to find more data about it from your site.
Yeah, definitely. And we started about 10, 11 years ago, needed to do research as part of my job, and said, well, I want to do something I like. So that's where EFT came about. I guess my area, clinical area, is eating disorders. So very typical anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa. Very hard to run clinical trials in those areas. So obesity was a better answer for us. The reason we chose food cravings, and that's where we started, was food cravings are correlated with the eating of the food and then are linked to obesity. So that's sort of, we zero in, because a lot of obese people do have food cravings as well as emotional eating. So we target both in our research. The fact that we got 4,500 people when we ran our first trial really flagged, 10, 11 years ago, people need assistance in this area. Obviously, we didn't have that many people go through the program, but we started there and kind of have spent 10 years looking at it. So we do look at things like willpower, the power of food. So if food is sitting on a table in front of you, and conferences always make me laugh because they put those pots of, mints and Mentos. So if it's there, do you find you have to eat it? So we measure that, because most obese people, even though they're not paying attention to it, have to eat it. So we measure that restraint ability we talked about, as well as your standard things like anxiety, depression, somatic symptoms. And what's come out of the EFT research is every single variable that we measure, including weight and body mass index, everything improves with EFT, and a year later stays improved. And that's at a statistical significance level. So, you know, the latest research we did was we compared it to cognitive behavioral therapy, so that gold standard, pretty standard traditional therapy out there.
Yep.
And CBT works for weight loss for certain people, and it did work for depression symptoms. So the CBT did work for that. What was superior about tapping was the anxiety and the food cravings. So the CBT people that went through that treatment did not have any response on food cravings and anxiety 12 months later. They had gone back to eating their food. Whereas we know everybody that taps can't remember the food that they ate 12 months later when we check in with them. They have no idea. They're like, oh, I don't eat that anymore. And you're like, the apex effect. So our most recent trial, and I just saw the results 2 days ago of this, wow, was we, oh no, so this is fresh, hot.
I was just going to say, I feel privileged.
Was we decided that we couldn't reach everybody. So all of our trials, people turned up in person, had 8 weeks worth, 16 hours of tapping. But that doesn't reach everybody when we're in Queensland. So we converted the whole program to an online delivery. So Suzanne alluded to that before with Glenn McIntosh. So we converted that to 80-odd videos, mostly of me, and everybody was able to log on worldwide, work through that program, and have human support at an online group level from Glenn and I. So the 12-month results, so we compared a group that waited, so a control group, to the treatment group, and then the control group did get their treatment. And we've now finished the 12-month follow-up of both groups. So the results yesterday...
Yes.
Yesterday, the day before, where we got significant change on every variable, exactly the same as attending in person.
Wow. That's
what that says.
That's fabulous.
I know. So if it's comprehensive enough, as in the tapping program and delivered online, we now know, at least in this weight area, it works as well as attending in person. So 12 months later, same results, weight loss, all the rest, as attending. So to us, there's something in that. The online delivery has got a lot of potential. My caveat is, as long as it's detailed enough, and I guess after 10 years, we did know, like you with trauma, I know with weight loss, what it is that you have to do your tapping on to get the shift to make them stick. So as long as that's included in there, you're going to get the results. So there you go, hot off the press, hasn't even been published yet.
That's so fabulous. I'm so excited to hear that. And I'm just curious, with the weight loss, are we seeing it increase over time? Are we seeing it reach a peak with the tapping and then stabilize? And I'm just curious what you're noticing.
So what we notice is there might be a tiny little bit of weight loss in the 8 week program. That's not significant. We're noticing the significant weight loss is at 6 months and it's staying reduced at 12 months. So at least a year after from when they start, the weight loss that they might be losing, roughly around 15 pound in your language, is staying lost. So they're not eating the foods that they did the tapping on, and they're actually, they've forgotten about them. So there's no willpower involved. They're not having to use that. And most of them, when we ask, haven't continued tapping. So they do it for the program, but they don't continue over time, which means the program's enough to get that change.
That's fabulous. Yeah. Do you have any other questions about that piece, Suzanne, or are we okay?
Yes, I actually do want to ask. I'll confess, I've done the online program. And one of the things that I found so helpful about it, and that I really... find was really helpful in terms of the tapping, was the amazing comprehensiveness of everything. So, Peter, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, I was just amazed at, like, okay, for one thing, like, I'm tapping on wasting food, okay? I never, ever would have thought about tapping on that before. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be a really significant point for me. But can you talk about the other points that you tap on in the program? Because I think that would be of interest to our practitioners.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess because we had that 10 years behind us, we'd read people's diary entries and things like that. We knew that there were a whole range of different emotions, like some of those we mentioned. You know, deprivation is a huge one. So if we say to somebody, no, you're not allowed to have a certain food, that inner child and that anger that comes up, you know, that was a topic that perhaps got tapped on. And the way we structured the program was, we were a little bit sneaky, was we knew some people would go, I don't have that issue, and skip the video. So we made it that they couldn't do that, that every video, whether I had one on anxiety, one on anger, one on deprivation, whatever it might have been, they had to actually watch the video and answer two questions, which weren't hard, in order to move to the next one. And the amount of feedback we got from people in our online group that said, I didn't think that video, for example, on wastage, I didn't think that related to me because I can throw food out. But because I had to do the video to move to the next one, all this stuff came up that I didn't realize was there, and I'm so glad I did it. So we did do that on purpose because we didn't want people to jump ahead and think that, oh, I don't have that issue, I don't have any anger issues, I'm fine. And then once they started to tap, stuff came up and they were able to kind of progress. So we did structure it that way. We're a little bit sneaky. So we covered all of the feelings and beyond, but we covered things like how to increase your interest in eating a healthy food. So that's something that doesn't get tapped on a lot, where, yeah, we use it for food cravings, you know, don't eat a chocolate bar anymore. But what about, where's the level of interest in perhaps eating a salad? So you see me in the videos, like you would have, Suzanne, where I have this giant bowl of salad. I'm holding it up. And I'm like, when you look at this, how do you feel? Because what happens for people with healthy food is they're like, there's no interest. But you can use tapping to boost your interest in things like that. So we did a whole range of those kind of videos, which was great. I heard about people that suddenly loved carrots and cauliflower, you know, stuff like that. We did alcohol. So we actually covered alcohol in the online program, and we recommended people do those videos at the time of day that they normally drank, you know, the wine or the beer or the spirit or whatever it was. So they went and got it and physically had it. I had a glass of Chardonnay in my video, which I don't drink, so there you go. We included alcohol. We had things like exercise and motivation, so we increased interest in and motivation in exercise, because most of the time obese people do have a negative, you know, connotations about the idea of exercise and what that means. So we covered all of those sorts of things in the modules as well. It's a whole range of different things that perhaps people, you know, didn't necessarily think of. And probably the last one that comes to mind are things around weight loss. If you were your ideal body shape, what would other people in your life think? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? Have you lost weight before and what happened? So we certainly covered all those kind of topics, because often people stay the way they are to keep other people comfortable in their life, mm-hmm. particularly in the weight area. They don't want to change because it'll change that. So we use tapping for those kind of things. So it evolved, and we now do have an advanced program now than even from the clinical trial. So we've actually added even more into that, which is available to the general public now, than what the clinical trial got. So Glenn's area is obviously mindfulness. So there's a lot of that kind of work included too now.
And that's available to anyone who would like to take it?
And yes,
it's online?
It's all online. We do run it as a structured program, a bit like your Tapping Out of Trauma program, where they're set dates. And that enables Glenn and I to both be available in the online space, the group that supports them, and people can directly ask us. So we schedule two or three of those a year, where everybody is together in completing that program, and they're not out there alone.
Well, I have to say it was a remarkable program. And as you pointed out, one of the things that was, I thought, very helpful in the tapping aspect was in certain parts of the program, having the actual food, whether it was a healthy food or a glass of water or a craving, right there, or doing it at a time when you would definitely choose to do it anyway, and was just really, really helpful. I mean, I just can't say enough about how well-structured the program was, and it just gave me such insights as a tapping practitioner into how many different aspects go into looking at obesity as trauma, and how many different areas need to be cleared. And yet that comprehensiveness, I think, is what makes it work. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
So I have a question. Given the potential underlying of trauma and given our concerns about somebody with deep trauma working on themselves, and yet a program like this is instructing people as far as self-tapping, I wonder if you could just speak a little bit about your thoughts on to what degree and when and in what topics one should or should not be tapping on events, history, concerns of self-tapping versus working with a practitioner.
Yeah, really good point. Because we knew that for a certain group, trauma was going to come up, whether or not they were aware of it in the beginning or it became evident once they started tapping. So whilst we did do videos on the movie technique, so if somebody, you know, was able to do that, we were fairly clear. And because we run them as structured programs where Glenn and I are there in the group, they're not just buying an online program, because we felt out of the clinical trials, that was the standout thing, was the human support element. And I would probably never, ever sell an online program like that without that in-person support. Right. We were there for that reason, either to make a referral to somebody in their local area or to talk to them, you know, at a private email level or Skype or whatever it might be, if somebody felt like. And there were people that had forgotten what had happened. And we had a 70-year-old woman, just as an example, small country town in America. And when she was thinking of that answer to the question of when did my weight gain start, she realized it started around the age of 16. She wasn't too sure why. She's now 70 doing our program. And she realized it was attached to puberty and development. So in a small country town, it wasn't okay to kind of experience any of those feelings, so she started to eat to quell them, and she became a nun. So she actually, for whatever reason, chose a pathway and became an obese nun to quell the sexuality feelings that started with puberty, and that only came out through the tapping program. But we were able to support her individually in seeking somebody locally that didn't know her to unpack some of that stuff, because she had no idea that's what the reason was until tapping unveiled some of it. So you're right. The human and the in-person parallel support there, I think, is absolutely essential, because we say you never know what you're going to unpeel. You just have no idea sometimes.
So I just want to qualify. So the online, so the support that they were able to call you, as opposed to self-tapping versus a coach tapping with them. In other words, saying that the support included you tapping with the individual, or I just want to kind of clean that up a little bit.
It was rare that we provided the support. So mostly if they needed to contact us, it was to get a referral to go and see somebody in person, face to face in their area, which we then sort of set up. So it was rarer for Glenn and I to do it one-on-one with them. Yeah.
Okay. So as far as ongoing program, when is the next time that you launch this program?
So this next program launches in July. So we run a program in July, and then which is our winter here in Australia, but that could be summer elsewhere in the world. And then the next one will actually be around October. So those, they are open. So if people want to register their interest, and then when the time comes before that, obviously become involved, they will get direct access, which is rare at a research level to get direct access to the people that developed it.
And what's the best link for that, so people know?
So the best link there is weightmanagementpsychology.com, and then within that website you'll see the EFT online program.
Okay. And if they want to find out or be able to print out the research that we're talking about and lots more, the best website for that is petastapleton.com or something else?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So
that one will show the link for the research.
Yeah, we'll have that on the site where we have the video. Great. Okay, that's fabulous. Thank you so much. Suzanne, you want to?
Yes. So you've heard us talk to wonderful PETA, who we both are in love with. And we want to let you know that we have a Tapping Out of Trauma course coming up. And like her programs, it's online, but we also do offer support through a group. And Craig and I are very available during the 8 weeks for anything that might come up for people in the course. It's geared towards EFT practitioners, not people who want to do their individual tapping work, but these are people who are working as tapping practitioners or energy psychology work, who want to know more about working with people with trauma. And we do all the science behind the thing, and we do a case study, and we give lots of room for people to understand the whole gamut of trauma from acute to complex, and also to look at how we can keep ourselves safe and not end up in vicarious trauma from working with people in trauma, and to help people discover whether or not this is an area that they want to work in. Now, almost everybody who's a tapper, well, practitioner, will run into people with some kind of trauma in their life. But there may be certain people with a great deal of trauma, with a high ACEs score, for instance, or whatever, where you might want to know how to refer, and you might realize, you know, this is not my thing. And so we cover that in the class as well. It's 8 weeks online. It's timed. So there's a start date and a finish date. There's a private online group for asking questions, and we are able to offer to a number of different professions 19 hours of continuing education. But it does mean some work on your part. Craig, anything else you want to add here?
You covered almost everything, I guess. Well, number one, you can go to tappingoutoftrauma.com and find out more information. We've just had really so many people we've been privileged to be able to serve. And I think really what always touches my heart is when we get those stories, you know, those stories from a practitioner that they've been through their training, they've even been certified, they've worked with mentors and all of those things, but they're out there a year or two or three or four or whatever. And then all of a sudden they hit that landmine. You know, they never worked with somebody that they were working on the emotional eating and the sexual abuse showed up. And so how do you handle that? What are the different tools? And I think as we become more comfortable with those tools, we're less anxious about those things coming up. They really amplify and make our sessions more effective. We provide a grounded presence on a whole nother level that is, you know, perceived but not even spoken of. So as we have more and more of those tools, because there's only so much that we can learn in our beginning in our EFT trainings. I mean, there's already so much to learn, as PETA, you and I know, that it's really behooves every tapping practitioner to continue their education, continue their training, continue their skills. And because EFT is so dang effective and it goes so deep so quickly, we really have to prepare ourselves better for those kinds of circumstances and stories and experiences that people bring to us. So this is like your next level of training in trauma. So you can also know what I should work with, what I shouldn't work with, depending on licensure, etc. What are my resources? How do I help them expand their resources to clients? And so we really cover a lot of that information, and I'm really proud of it, and we get a lot of great feedback. So that's what I love about it. And so
Our reason for doing this, one of our primary reasons, was to keep everyone safe.
Absolutely. Yeah, primary. So, you know, I don't know whether I have more fun in the class or more fun with these interviews and classes and these wonderful events that we get. And I'm just really so grateful, PETA, that you agreed to join us and to help all the people that are listening to really gain more insight into not just emotional eating, but emotional eating, trauma, food, weight issues, body issues, that and how interconnected they are with adverse experiences and traumas. And I really couldn't think of anybody else that would do that subject more justice than you. So thank you for all you do, and thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And March 10th, we start our next Tapping Out of Trauma course.
Yes, March 10th. We will see you then. Tapping Out of Trauma. We look forward to seeing you there, and we look forward to seeing you. Thank you for coming and joining us today at Tapping Out of Trauma.
Yes. Thank you.